Hi, I'm Amanda Hale. This is my fourth podcast in the Mad Hatter series. Mad Hatter is the title of my latest novel, published by Guernica Editions. The dedication reads, "To all those loving women who cooked, cleaned, kept house, cared for us children, and taught us to read." And I name a few of them. Mrs. Fern, Lydia Hope, Mrs. Ward, Mary Simpson, Miss Dixon, Amy Barrowdale, Vera, Elsie, the Nicoles, and Catty Coons. Only a few, the ones whose names I remember, for there was indeed an army of girls and women who passed through my family's employ, many of them now nameless for us. This has become clear to me while sifting through family photos. Sometimes I encounter a strange face amidst my extended family, without a name on the back of the photograph to identify her. One of my narrators in Mad Hatter is Mary Byrne, a young Irish girl working as housekeeper nanny in Cynthia Brooke's house during the war years of her husband's internment. Mary is a purely fictional character in a cast largely based on real people. She struggles to understand her relationship to Cynthia, who, when she feels lonely, befriends Mary, but reverts to her role as mistress of the house when it suits her. When, for instance, her husband comes home on leave from his internment, and again when he is released and comes home to live with the family once more, disrupting their routine. One wartime Christmas, Mary is invited to join Cynthia and her children at a large family gathering. She is there, of course, to watch over the three young children and the baby. Mary is a keen observer and has this to say about the dinner gathering, which is in the house of Cynthia's parents, the Blackwells, and is attended by Cynthia's sisters, Ruby and Margaret, and all the extended family of uncles, aunts, and cousins. Ruby burst out with the news that she'd been accepted by the Red Cross. "I'm going to the front as an ambulance driver," she announced with great importance. "No daughter of mine is going to war," Mr. Blackwell said, and Mrs. Blackwell replied, "Nonsense, Dick. Ruby will make us proud. Besides, unmarried girls are being conscripted now, so you can't stop her." The other sister, Margaret, was studying for a career in photography. It was likely her who had taken some of the photos I had been studying when I found that stash in the hat box in my bedroom. After the meal, she was up with her camera snapping away at us. Not me, of course, for I was not part of the family. But she took many photos of the children, and no doubt I was caught in one or two of them, though I never did see them. They were a close family in spite of everything. "Blood is thicker than water," Cynthia was fond of saying, when she wasn't complaining about her family. I had written this in a torrent of memory mixed with imagination, perching myself in Mary's chair, off to the side at a small table with the children, familiar as I was with those family gatherings. Only later, after many rounds of rewrites with both substantive and detailed line-by-line edits, did I realize how very sad it was to hear Mary say, "I was not part of the family. No doubt I was caught in one or two of the photographs, though I never did see them." She was robbed of an important part of her history, though later in the novel we learn that Mary had her own little box camera, a gift from Cynthia, and that years later she has kept and treasured the snaps she took of Cynthia's children at a picnic on a sunny day. This reminds me of the documentary film Finding Vivian Mayer, about an archive of negatives discovered, photographs taken by a mysterious and talented woman who was also a nanny in New York City and took brilliant photos of her charges and of New Yorkers walking on the streets. "We children were like dogs. We wanted to keep the pack together. When one of those loving women disappeared from our lives, we were sad and confused. We didn't understand about class difference or xenophobia. Why couldn't they have come back to visit us, become friends of our family?" I have a 5-year-old friend called Quinn, a little boy adopted as a baby from Vietnam. I often visit him and his family for sleepovers, and when I leave, he gets angry and upset. "Why can't she live with us?" he reasonably asks after my departure. Why indeed? I can't actually think of a rational answer to that one, Quinn. Not all of those women were kind. Some were mourning for fiancés killed in the war. Some were poverty-stricken, struggling to survive, and many of those women were war widows, like Miss Lawson, our matron at boarding school, in charge of a house full of girls, working her way through the dreary post-war 1950s. Miss Lawson had it in for me from the beginning. She disliked me for some reason I couldn't fathom. I tried to please her, but gradually I became afraid of her and sneaked around, trying to avoid her. Miss Lawson's room was downstairs at the corner of the house. We girls lived in units of houses on Clarence Drive and walked over to the main college building for classes, gymnastics, prayers, chapel, sports, and so on. On the rare occasions that Miss Lawson's door was open a crack, there was a strong smell of cigarette smoke. She was a chain smoker with nicotine-stained fingers and a tough, leathery look to her skin. Even her greying hair had a yellowish tinge to it. I imagined her room like a lion's den, all smoky and jaundiced. My sister'd had jaundice, and we'd all been alarmed to see her turn bright yellow. It was Miss Lawson's job to ring the big handbell every morning to wake us girls, but sometimes she slept in, and the head girl of our house, Pussy Turner, so named because she had a faint furry moustache, would step in and ring the bell to wake us. Miss Lawson, we called her Laurie behind her back, would be especially grumpy on those mornings as she roused herself. Looking back on it, I realize she was probably hungover. Every other Wednesday was hair-washing day, and we would line up at the white porcelain sink to have our scalps scrubbed vigorously by Laurie. She had tough, curved nails like an animal's claws, and she scrubbed so hard that she made my head bleed. After we were toweled dry, we lined up in the dispensary to have our hair blown dry. She had the hairdryer on top volume, which burned our heads and made us look wild and windswept, at a time of adolescence when we so wanted to look our best with smooth hair. We secretly wore rollers in our hair at night and endured uncomfortable and sometimes sleepless nights for the promise of a better look in the mirror next morning. My sister, who was at the same boarding school, also felt disliked by Miss Lawson. It's only very recently that I have realized why she had it in for us. I've been so entrenched in a habitual feeling of rejection and a reactive hatred for the woman that I never in all these years stretched beyond it. The writing of Mad Hatter has, however, clarified many mysteries for me, including the source of Laurie's animosity towards us. The man she loved had been killed in a war which our father had refused to participate in. Not only that, but my father had been named and reviled multiple times in the British gutter press as a traitor, a member of the British Union of Fascists. I knew nothing of this at the time. I had no idea of the force of wartime patriotism, nor of the terrible grief people had suffered in losing their loved ones. I knew only my mother's deep sadness and disappointment, which lasted throughout my childhood, until she remarried and began to lead a happier life. Interestingly, Miss Lawson is twinned in memory with my maternal grandmother, Dorothy Metcalf, who had a similar attitude to me. As an overly sensitive and emotional child, I became acutely aware of the similarity of emotions I apparently evoked in both Laurie and Granny. My mother's parents had encouraged her to end the marriage. When, instead of doing that, she produced a fourth child, her mother in particular was shocked and judgmental. She viewed me as a further burden on her daughter, a nuisance, a mistake. These emotions can be far-reaching. I longed for the approval and love of those two strong women, Miss Lawson and Dorothy Metcalf, thinking that I could win them over simply by being myself. But of course their attitudes to me were coloured politically by my father's mistaken wartime alliances. There was nothing I could ever have done about it. It was not personal. This realization is part of the liberation I have felt since presenting Mad Hatter to my reading public, receiving a level of acclaim and understanding I could never have anticipated. It has allowed in me a deeper understanding, and therefore a level of compassion for those women. Another character in Mad Hatter who suffered from wartime bereavement is Nanny Darlington, who lived with Granny and Grandpa Brooke and looked after their children, Christopher and Alice. I'll read you a couple of short sequences about Nanny Darlington that speak for themselves. In the first scene, we're at Dinglewood, the home of Christopher Brooke's parents. It is Christmas Day, and Alice has come from London to join them. After lunch, the siblings disappear, and Cynthia goes upstairs looking for them. Grown-ups were sitting around like stuffed turkeys, and Grandpa Brooke had disappeared in a haze of cigar smoke and brandy fumes, when Cynthia noticed that Christopher was missing. Alice, too. Her husband Morris sat contentedly jiggling their 2-year-old daughter on his knee. "Where's Alice?" she asked. "Oh, I expect she's gone to powder her nose," Morris replied calmly. "They're all the same in that family," Cynthia thought. "Cold fish." She felt impatient with the gentility of the gathering and almost wished for a good argument to disrupt it. She left Charlotte in charge of the other children, and excusing herself to Granny Brooke, she left the room. She stood a moment in the main hall, inhaling the richness of old wood permeated with the aroma of family life. Dinglewood was a sizable house in Tudor style, surrounded by an extensive acreage of garden and woodland. She had been impressed upon her first visit there in the spring of 1931 for her introduction to Christopher's parents. She remembered how shy she'd felt, seated at dinner next to old Mr. Brooke, who had teased her. "Will you have white meat or dark?" he had inquired, as he'd stood poised to carve a large capon resting on a Crown Derby serving dish. "Dark meat, please," she'd replied, thinking that white meat was the prize and that she should make a modest choice. "Ah, a girl who knows the best cut," he'd said with a growl. "The leg is by far the richer and juicier choice over the breast," he said, leaning in so close that she could see droplets of wine clinging to his moustache. "Serve the bird, Daddy," Nancy had said. "Our dear Cynthia must be building an appetite with all this talk of the best cut."
"You do know, of course, how we come by the capon, how it differs from the common chicken, Cynthia?"
She had looked to Christopher for help. She hadn't understood Brooke's laughter. It sounded like wet gravel. She had begun to laugh herself, babbling about the roast beef they ate at her father's table, with blood gravy from the dish, spooned over the meat. And he always says,
"It's made a bonny girl of you," Brooke said.
After the meal, she had asked Christopher what a capon was, and he had tried to explain that it was an unmanned rooster. "Oh, how cruel!" she'd exclaimed.
"To make the meat more tender," he had explained.
Cynthia inhaled deeply and crossed the hall to the main staircase, which branched on either side onto a long upstairs landing. She climbed the stairs and paused on the landing, listening. A sound of voices came from a bedroom at the far end. She tiptoed down the landing to the door that stood ajar. She heard Christopher's voice, his soft laughter, and saw Alice, the gesture of her long arm. Cynthia pushed the door open, and they turned to her laughing. "What are you doing up here?" Cynthia asked. "Reminiscing about old times," Christopher said. "This used to be our nursery." "I was worried about you." "My cot was over there," Alice said, pointing towards the window that looked onto the back garden, "and Nanny Darlington slept there." She pointed to a narrow bed with a faded pink chenille cover. "Has Chris told you about Nanny Darlington?" She touched Christopher's arm gently, as though she were addressing him. "Well, yes. I mean, he's mentioned her, of course," she trailed off. "Well, as long as you know. It's always fun to come home and remember the old times, isn't it, Chris?" She slipped her hand into his, and their long arms began to swing to and fro. Cynthia stood there, not knowing what to do. She felt foolish and acutely embarrassed, as though all the focus was on her exclusion. "You must come downstairs, Christopher." "Did I ever show you my party trick, Cynthia?" Alice asked brightly. "Look!" She turned her back, and with her neck twisted archly so that she was looking at Cynthia from the corner of her eye, she folded her arms across her body until she was firmly clasped in her own embrace. Christopher started to giggle, a hoarse little boy sound which set his body all a tremble. Cynthia watched in fascination as Alice's hands began to caress her own shoulders, creeping slowly, slowly down her back, all the while smoothing, squeezing, caressing, until Cynthia had to turn away because she realized with a shock that Alice had become two people. She was whispering now in a breathy, passionate voice, "Oh, darling, don't stop! I love you so!" and making little moaning sounds. Cynthia's hands rose up, hovering by her ears, wanting to cover them, but unable to. Christopher was bent over, laughing so hard that he had tears running down his face. "Stop, Alice, stop," he said. "I can't stand any more."
"Chris can do it even better," Alice said, laughing and spinning around suddenly. "Go on, show her."
Then she saw Cynthia's face.
"I hope I haven't upset you."
There was an awkward silence, broken only by the tail end of Christopher's breathy mirth.
"Well, I must go and relieve Morris. I left him holding the baby."
Alice laughed again and sauntered out, leaving Christopher and Cynthia standing in the middle of the room. He wiped his face with a handkerchief, little tremors of laughter still erupting as he recovered himself.
"It's so good to see Alice. I've missed her."
"You have me."
He noticed then that something was amiss, and he opened his arms to Cynthia. When she turned away, he took a few steps towards her and placed his hands on her shoulders. She swung her arms up across her body and grasped his hands, pulling them down onto her breasts. Then she turned and raised her face to him, her lips parted.
"I want you here, in this room," she said.
"We can't, not here. They'll wonder."
"Let them. You're my husband. Lock the door."
She sat on the narrow bed and pulled him down with her, tugging at his trousers to release him. But he was unwilling and unable to satisfy her.
"What is it? What's wrong?"
"Nanny Darlington made a naughty boy of me in this bed."
"What do you mean?"
"She was lonely. She made me stroke her, then she smacked my bottom and sent me back to my bed. Told me not to tell anyone."
"Oh, for goodness sake, you were a little boy. That's all in the past," she said, nuzzling into his neck.
"It happened night after night."
"Will you stroke me?"
A little later, Christopher and Cynthia are in London to meet up with colleagues who had befriended Christopher in the internment camp on the Isle of Man. They were to dine at Prunier's in Piccadilly, where they would meet up with Baker and Unsworth. But Cynthia was late in dressing because she had lain down for a nap upon their arrival at the Park Lane. She had wanted Christopher to lie with her and had done her utmost to persuade him, but he'd said quite simply, "I'm not tired, darling," and had crossed into the sitting room of their suite to read the newspaper. She had lost her confidence since their encounter in the nursery at Dinglewood. Perhaps she had responded too passionately for him. She'd sensed something afterwards, disgust almost, as though it was too intimate for him, too close and fetid. She'd watched him on the tennis court and the cricket pitch. He was in his element there, and he approached their lovemaking with a similar enjoyment, as though it was a sport to be engaged in quickly and enthusiastically, like scoring a goal in football. Just as she thought she had him, he'd be gone again, back to that distant place from which she was excluded. She had asked Nancy Brooke about Nanny Darlington, remembering what Chris had said in the nursery that day. "Did something happen to her? Christopher said she was a rather unhappy woman."
"She lost her fiancé in the Great War, dear, and she couldn't seem to get over it, always weeping and, well, quite unsuitable for the children. We had to send her away."
And so we see just one of the far-reaching effects of war on human lives, affecting not only the adults but their children and their children's children down the generations. Thank you for listening. There will be more podcasts every couple of weeks. Mad Hatter is available in paperback and as an e-book from Guernica Editions. The audiobook is at audible.com, where you can hear a 5-minute sample reading. For information on all my books, see my website, amandahale.com. My work is also available through Canadian libraries and at the unavoidable Amazon.